Thanks, everyone, for coming. So this is a talk partially based on some psychological research I've been doing. I guess to introduce the broad premise of the talk, on-call tends to split our industry in two. There are those who hate doing it and those who actually like hating doing it. Anyone disagree? More seriously, instant response is indeed one of the key responsibilities of SRE, but it's pretty difficult to find people who like it in a sustainable way. Of those who do, a certain number of them are maybe self-confessed adrenaline junkies like the original SRE ad, who like the thrill of deadlines and pressure and saving the day and so on. And there's also a lot of people who like being heroes. So good on them for the community spirit and the skill and the volunteerism it shows. However, if your organization is essentially based on gluing together a series of acts of heroism, this is not a sustainable response to the challenges of running production services, I would argue. It's not a system, right? It's not something you can practice for or hope to improve in a meaningful way, or basically do anything other than react. And so a series of acts of heroism eventually meets an end of level body that can't be conquered by your heart being pure. And so few of us have pure hearts these days. So there is an ambiguity, I think, in our reaction to on-call at the heart of our profession. The psychological research I was referring to at the start is that there's a lot of material here based on the book Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. If you haven't read it, I really, really strongly recommend you read it. It is amazing. It will absolutely change your mind about how human beings operate. Consequently, this talk will probably recap some material you already know, but I promise there will be other newer material later. Okay, so let me change tack a little bit. Okay, does that look like an optical illusion on your screen? I mean, to your eyes? Okay, so that's, to me, that seems to be waving. And apparently, the reason for this is that the illusion is structured in such a way that certain of the neurons that match will say green or dots, edges in particular places on the screen are also triggering optical circuitry that recognizes movement. Okay, so for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to ask you to believe, like just like there are weird, unexpected things in your optical circuitry, which maybe lead you astray or lead you to believe that something is happening that's not, there are similar weirdnesses in our cognitive circuitry which do the very same thing. Well, actually, I'm not going to ask you to believe it. Hopefully, I'm going to demonstrate this. A little bit like Ireland's sole physics Nobel Prize winner, Ernest Walton, who discovered there was detailed internal structure to the atom by bombarding it with stuff until something unexpected came back. We can examine our reactions to things and compare them and see where we act in discontinuous ways. Conversely, I guess, if you are a person who believes that you are perfectly rational and everything you do is perfectly rational and founded upon good sense and you have no biases or otherwise imperfections in your mental framework, I do have to tell you that the evidence is overwhelmingly strong that you are incorrect. And even if it wasn't, you could also argue that a certain amount of creativity derives from non-rational combinations of ideas. Well, I won't pursue that too far, but I would ask you to say that while you choose to believe that you are without mental imperfection in any way, I'm going to talk about behaviors that happen at the population level. So you yourself can believe what you believe about yourself, and that's fine, but the population as a whole can exhibit these other behaviors, and there's no inconsistency in those positions. So that's fine. Okay. So the talk works either way, with the mild proviso that if there are any real psychologists in the audience or actual statisticians, I would like to ask you to leave now. Because otherwise you're going to be wincing about how much I am murdering this material for the remainder of this period. Anyway. Okay. So let's talk about dual process theory. Starting with the basics, fundamental precept is that an effective model for how the brain works is that it's actually divided into two, or human cognition is divided into two modes. There's one that's fast, sloppy, and it uses kind of bad heuristics in certain circumstances, but it's fast, and did I mention it was fast? That's really useful. There's one that's slow, it's deliberate, it's tiring, takes energy, and it's kind of awkward to use, but generally speaking, it has a much higher chance of being correct, but it's slow. Did I mention it was slow? So in this model, they are called system one and system two. System one is the fast one, and system two is the slow one. So just as there is a division in their competences, there is also somewhat of a division in the circumstances under which they reflect themselves, or under which they come into use, I think, come to life. Broadly speaking, you can think of system one as subconscious activity. It gets used, or it comes to the fore, is probably a more accurate way of putting it, when, for example, we're detecting whether or not one object is more distant than another. That one is small, that one is far away. Or we're doing simple kind of maths that can be pattern recognized, like what's 2 + 2? The answer will, in general, almost flash unbidden into your mind. Completing phrases, orienting to the source of a sound, swatting mosquitoes, which is what I did in my holidays, driving on an empty road. You can push a lot of that kind of activity into subconscious work. And recognizing stereotypes, that's a big one. So it's important to note that the operation of system one is in general involuntary, okay? You can't really help but complete 2 + 2. If I tell you to stand in the corner and not think of raspberry jam, you'll probably think of raspberry jam. Like our mental systems have a complicated architecture. many of these things happen without our conscious control. So it's a system, I guess, to be slightly evolutionary about it for a moment, it's a system that when we're, loping across the steps, thinking about what color we're going to paint the okapi on the cave wall when we get home or whatever, this system will allow us to recognize a predator and go, they're about 200 meters away. This is a metric plasticine or whatever. Anyway. This is a system which will allow us to do rapid calculations which are useful for preserving our lives. So system two is kind of a different beast. System two is when you're paying attention. System two is when you're reasoning, when you're actively working at something. System two allows you to pick the voice of somebody out of a noisy room. System two will allow you to get your tax form done, that is, of course, if there's nothing more appealing on television, that system two will allow you to search your memory, retrieve stuff from memory, for example, a surprising sound. System two will help you reflect on how you're acting in a social situation, a lot of stuff. Usually, however, there's only one thing that system two will allow you to do at a time. For example, most people cannot make an against traffic turn while also calculating 19 times 168. If you can, let me know, we're hiring. Focusing intently on something effectively and getting it done does make you blind to certain other stimuli, even those that would normally attract attention. I presume a number of people here have also seen the famous video where a number of people are playing basketball and you're asked to track where the ball is, and then a dancing gorilla goes around in the background and most people don't see the gorilla. This is because system two is occupied with a cognitive task and system one is kind of drowned out. So broadly speaking, situations with stress and situations where mental effort is continually required are situations where system one behavior is more likely to happen because it's cheaper. It's not more correct, but it is cheaper. So let's frame this in the context of on-call for a moment. It seems unquestionable that in on-call situations, the overall environment we're dealing with and the kind of things we have to solve, the kind of things we're on the hook for resolving in these situations are going to result in system one behavior. Like when we're fixing something, when we're fixing something quickly, we're making intuitive judgments about risks, probabilities, summoning sequences we're very familiar with to mind, all that kind of stuff. The strange thing is that actually, if you think about it, you probably want system two behavior for on-call, or at least it involves system two behavior as well. You have extremely complicated, perhaps arbitrarily complicated production setups with this feeding into this, which is known to fail when this other thing happens, and so on. We are reasoning our way around potentially completely unstable causal chains, systems, attempting to figure out what's wrong and why. So system two being distractible is the wrong word, more accurately possibly occupied, system two more easily occupied, and when questions arise that need urgent answers, system one will fill in the gap. It'll give you an answer, and quickly, that's what it's for, but there are situations where it's almost certainly wrong. So I would say that the industry is in some way not unaware of this situation in that best current practice involves things like playbooks, incident response protocols, and so on, all things which are designed to help you to not use system one more than you should. But similarly, but standing back, I'm not sure this best practice is evenly distributed. Standing back a bit, there's probably a bit of nuance in the cognitive behaviors or the structures which could be conceivably of use in on-call. For example, system one reacts quickly. Maybe it's a good idea to have consequence-free buttons that you can match. That might make the situation better or might make everyone react and have no serious downside. Like that might be a useful way to exploit system one's tendency to act quickly. So you could somehow leverage some of this behavior. But as against that, there are really big downsides to system one behavior. Really big ones. It is not intuitively good at statistics. It makes systemic errors. It hallucinates relations between things and causes where none exist. One thing actually that's possibly following on from my talk yesterday, it's way too confident. You get a feeling in your gut and you go, oh yeah, it's totally that. No, not necessarily. And it's hooked into cognition at such a low level, it's really, really hard to tell when you're thinking about something has been influenced by system one and when it hasn't. It's very hard for us to tell when we should treat our own ideas with skepticism. There's a book by Anthony Trollope called He Knew He Was Right. It turns out he wasn't, spoiler, okay. And this is the kind of thing that you can very easily lead you astray. Okay, enough about that. So let's talk about one of these malfunctions of cognition. There's a thing called anchoring. That picture is a picture of the anchor in my front garden, which was deemed useless about 16 years ago, but is now coming to increasing prevalence. So anchoring is the process around which, or by which, your thinking on a topic is anchored in some way, or on a range of values, by being even exposed to a suggestion. Not having somebody actively try to persuade you, but even just seeing a number can cause you to fixate on that number and inappropriately think it's the answer. It's incredibly powerful. It's an incredibly powerful technique, as anyone who works in supermarkets or used car sales can tell you, okay? It really, really works. There's two forms of it. There's a form which reflects itself in system two, which is when you anchor on something and by a process of adjustment, you're trying to get to what you think the right answer is. And then there's anchoring that occurs by priming, which is that instantaneous reaction to something you just see, and that's an automatic manifestation of system one. So there are a huge number of wonderful examples in the literature. Kahneman and Tversky have a couple. So they put together a wheel of fortune, okay? Numbers 1 to 100. They rigged it so it only ever stopped at 10 or 65. So they got a bunch of experimental subjects, sat them in front of it, span the wheel, it ended up at 10 or 65 in every case. Then they asked the group two questions. Is the percentage of African nations among UN members larger or smaller than the number you just saw? And what's your best guess of the percentage of those nations in the UN? Of course, what the wheel does is utterly disconnected from what that number is. But the groups that saw 10 on the wheel wrote down something which was 25% on average, and the groups that saw 65 on the wheel wrote down 45% as their average. There was no other difference between those groups in terms of the delivery of this information. They saw that number that had nothing to do with it, and it influenced their judgment. This is priming. So there's also the idea of adjusting from a baseline. They also discover that when you take a sheet of paper and you say, and you're asked to draw a line which is 2.5 inches long, you start at the bottom and you draw up. If you do that, the line tends to be shorter than if you turn the page and start at the top and draw all the way down until you're leaving a gap of 2.5. And the reason being, a subtle point, I guess, that there's obviously some uncertainty in how the length should be, but you stop near the bottom of the region of uncertainty when you start from the bottom of the page, and near the top of the region when you start from the top of the page. So similar arguments apply when you're asked things like, what's the boiling point of water on top of Mount Everest or something? You know that the normal boiling point is 100 Celsius, so you have to adjust it in some way, and the question is, how much to adjust it by. So adjustment also takes effort, or system two adjustment takes effort. You adjust less when you're tired, when you're drunk, on call and drunk, not good. When you're trying to remember lots of other stuff, or when your mental resources are otherwise depleted. So actually this is a meaningful effect. And amazingly, despite this being really, really strongly reproducible and the basis for many business models in the real world, people still don't think it affects them. There's a great story that I like, which I had a look at the original paper for. But for example, an experiment took a group of real estate agents to price a house on the market. So they went to see the house, showed them a booklet. The booklet had a list price, a different list price for half the group than for the other half. And anyone want to guess what happened? So, okay. Each agent gave what they thought was the price, right price range for the house, and stated why they thought that. Oh, you know, it has two bathrooms, or it's far back from the road, or whatever. Only about 15% of the agents said that the asking price in the booklet had anything to do with their price range. But in fact, the anchoring effect of the booklet for the real estate agents was 41%. So They also asked a bunch of business school students to do the same thing with essentially the same result, the 48% anchoring, except that the only meaningful difference between the two groups was that the professionals denied that the number in the booklet had anything to do with their result, and the business school students did not. So just think about that for a moment. There's obviously a lot more to say on this, but for the purpose of this conversation, let's bring it round back around to on-call. When I think of on-call and anchoring, I would say I certainly have seen, probably we all have seen cases where people have gone on wild goose chases, thinking about a particular value in a particular graph, thinking about a particular cause, a particularly weird result that somehow grabs attention, and it can be hard for them to escape that in some way. Maybe in the analysis of what went on, they added 2 + 2 to make 5. Or a colleague told them a result, one number for a particular metric, and that number could maybe get anchor somebody for another metric. Now, I know I've made mistakes like this, and I gotta guess that other people have too. But in the heat of an incident, with everything pushing you into system one behavior, it can be hard to realize that this is even what's happening. So, also in our profession, we have cause to estimate probability all the time, in life, actually, but particularly in our profession. It turns out that a large part of how we do this is based on a heuristic called availability. The simple version is that if we can think of loads of examples of it, we think it's probable, and if we can't, we don't. Now, actually, there's a bit of a wrinkle in there. But basically, we use the ease and fluency of retrieval of examples of a class. We use the ease and fluency of that act as a proxy for how probable the thing is. So unfortunately, that itself is a signal, right? So the relative ease or difficulty of that is a signal itself rather than the actual absolute effort, leading to weird outcomes where, if you ask groups to name 12 instances of when they were assertive, and other groups to name, 5 or 6 instances of where they were assertive, the struggling required to get to the last 3 or 4 from the group that have been asked to do 12 leads them to believe that they are less assertive than the group that was asked to come up with 6, despite finding twice as many examples. So this was a group of German psychologists led by Norbert Schwartz. So there's another way this is clear on a day-to-day basis. When we are called to estimate, for example, the chances of dying from a shark attack. Okay? So the media often publishes vivid stories for all kinds of business model reasons, I guess, usually about truly unfortunate, low-probability happenings such as shark attacks. For various reasons, this promotes them to being more available in our mind than other things. And so when we come to estimate death probabilities, Wikipedia, for example, claims that you are slightly more likely to be killed by falling airplane parts than a shark attack, which I'm not sure about. I have heard of both falling airplane parts and shark attacks in the media, but I'm not sure what ratio. But it seems clear that, like, tripping and falling, being killed by falling coconuts, or even being stabbed by an icicle are apparently all more probable than shark attacks in the US, which has a mortality rate of approximately 1 every 2 years. Well, humans are weird. I mean, we knew that. But another example of this is when you ask people to do the same experiment, which is asking people to name 6 instances of when they were assertive, say, while they are frowning, the very act of frowning, which normally accompanies deep cognitive effort, and indeed binds with that on a very deep level, causes that group to have more difficulty retrieving examples of when they were assertive than if they've been asked to smile. You can play fun games with this kind of thing, actually, if you're so inclined, and that you can get people to believe that they use their bicycles less often than after recalling many instances rather than few instances. You can get them to be less confident in a choice when they're asked to produce more rationales for it. Has that ever happened in on-call? Are less confident that an event was avoidable after listing more reasons why it could have been avoided, and are less impressed by, for example, a car or a computer or something after listing more of its advantages. So, again, to bring this to relevance to on-call, the act of using availability as a proxy for probability has a number of difficulties. I know that after talking over plausible scenarios with my team and searching my mind for examples and so on, I've discarded theories that later turned out to be true. Maybe you have too. Every postmortem that we do probably has an implicit, possibly even explicit, question of how avoidable it was. And it turns out that listing more ways in that postmortem that it could have been avoided makes it intuitively less likely that we will think that it could have been. So there's a blend, of course, between the ease with which instances come to mind under system one, which can be replaced by a focus on the content in system two when it's more engaged. There are various factors that can push people into more system one thinking about this rather than system two. For example, they're doing something else at the same time when they're in a good mood, because they just thought of a happy episode. If they are knowledgeable novices on the topic of a task, in contrast to true experts, and when they score high in faith and intuition. Fairly clear, I guess. So another cognitive discontinuity, also known as the conjunction fallacy, is a thing called the Linda problem, which is where our brains seem to get misled by specificity or representativeness, detail. So Kahneman Tversky defined representativeness as the degree to which an event is similar in essential characteristics to some kind of parent population, and it also reflects the process or the features of the process by which it's generated. So when people rely on representativeness to make judgments, they're basically quite likely to judge wrongly, because the fact that something is more representative doesn't necessarily make it more likely. Let's go with an example here, which is the famous example from the 1983 paper that started this all off. They asked participants to solve the following problem. So Linda is 31 years old, single, outspoken, and very bright. She majored in philosophy. As a student, she was deeply concerned with issues of discrimination and social justice, and also participated in demonstrations. So which is more probable? One, that Linda is a bank teller, or two, that Linda is a bank teller and active in the feminist movement. Okay, so a bunch of you probably have opinions, right? So it turns out that the majority, somewhere around 89% of people in some studies, but certainly the majority of people, pick number two over number one. And the explanation for this is that, Stephen Jay Gould has a great line, which is, quote, "I'm particularly fond of this example, the Linda problem, because I know that the conjoint statement is, strictly speaking, mathematically less probable, yet there's a little homunculus in my brain jumping up and down, shouting at me, but she can't just be a bank teller, read the description." Sadly, mathematically, physics and all that, it's actually not true. The statement Linda is a bank teller and has property X, no matter what the property X is at most equally probable, but it's less probable than, quotes, Linda is a bank teller, end quotes, right? So we seem to get misled by the detail. We've been fed a lot of things that enable us to somehow create Linda in our mind, and all kinds of other properties get swept in an associative kind of way. I guess part of the reason why this works, and there are some studies showing this, is because the properties in question are so vivid. If you repeat the experiment with Jane is a teacher, and Jane is a teacher and walks to work with no story, people pick the right one. But if you feed them the story, they pick the wrong one. So basically, this is because system one is doing the job of evaluating plausibility and coherence, and in the second case, there's nothing to work with, there's no story. Or to put it another way, in the absence of a competing intuition, logic will prevail, but the hard thing is avoiding the intuition. This result has been controversial for many decades, so it is unquestionably true, though. So, questions of risk assessment and estimation of probability and so on are central to our profession, certainly central to on-call. It is a pity, then, that humans are in general so bad at it, or more accurately, that they have such discontinuities around it. What do I mean? Part of that depends on what kind of model you have for how people think, of course. So let's talk about that a little bit. So up here on this table, we have a number of different probabilities of you getting $1 million. Previously, Bernoulli's utility theory just stated that the unit change, the unit chance of you having a gain was all that mattered with respect to human beings' decision-making about utility in general. So in this case, rows A, B, C, and D are all equally positive under that theory. But of course, when you talk to actual human beings, there's a huge difference. There's a huge difference between a no percent chance of getting something and a 5% chance, and there's a huge difference between 95 and 100. So we have specific discontinuities around moving from nothing into the realm of possibility and moving from possibility into certainty. 0 to 5, the possibility effect causes highly unlikely outcomes to be weighted in our minds disproportionately more than they deserve. So that's why the lottery works, okay? The improvement from 95% to 100% is also another quantitative change, the certainty effect. Outcomes that are almost certain are given less weighting than they should be, than their probability justifies. So when we look at the decision weights that people apply to bands of probability, it turns out that our intuition is actually significantly at variance with this. So Kahneman and Tversky abandoned raw utility theory and came up with a thing called prospect theory, which reflects the fact that people are not perfectly rational choosers correctly. And it posits a number of things about humans actually evaluate prospects based on the idea that there's some kind of reference point, like the status quo, that relative gains and losses have diminishing sensitivity. In other words, going from $900 to $1,000 doesn't matter as much to people as going from 0 to 100 or 100 to 200. And we have strong loss aversion. So I don't need to tell an audience composed of reliability engineers that loss aversion is important. Of course it is, but it turns out that we have a discontinuity about how we think about that. And that strong sensitivity to losses is overweighted against the potential for gains. You can usually demonstrate the above by, in your own head, thinking, well, would I take a bet where heads I win $150 or tails I lose $100. Actually, most people don't take that bet. They feel, well, I don't actually want to lose that. And the amount by which you have to adjust the potential winning amount in order for people to take that bet tends to be between 1.5 and 2.5, which is interesting. Usually the ratio floats around there. So turns out that when you do the experiments, you get a table that looks a little bit like the above, where the raw percentage, raw probability is on the top, and how we think of that probability is on the bottom. So when you measure by getting people to, say, wager relatively small amounts of money on various stakes, this is the weight that people place on probabilities. So you have a curve that overweights improbable events, like a 1% chance of something happening. In our intuition, is much more like a 5%. Oh, that could actually happen. Right? That's 1 in 20. And a 99% chance of something happening is typically viewed as kind of 91% chance of something happening. And people will behave as if this is the case. They will wager money accordingly and so on. So this is system one, providing some intuition about what a certain probability feels like, but its curve is quite distorted from the linear reality. So I guess SRE as a profession is quite accustomed to thinking about low probability events. We also think about the negative impact of events, like there is a 0.001% chance of our data center being taken out, but if we do, we lose everything, so it's appropriate to spend some time and effort on backups or taping or another data center or whatever. So we have that. And with that in mind, I've been wondering if we are actually better at statistics than the general population is. But come on to that in a moment. But coming back to prospect theory and discontinuities in our thinking, this is the table, central table of prospect theory, really. Basically, theory runs, people attach values to gains and losses rather than to absolute amounts of wealth. And as discussed, the decision weights are different. The top row in each cell shows the scenario that's going to happen. The row underneath that is the mathematical calculation. The row under that is the description of how you're feeling, and then I think the row under that is basically what ends up happening or what would happen in a legal case or something like that. So it turns out that generally speaking, for high probability certainty effects, humans are usually risk averse for gains. In other words, they won't take a risk, they'll kind of consolidate. And risk seeking for avoiding losses when those are high probability. And conversely, for the other side, which is low probability gains, we will be risk seeking because we'll try and maximize what we gain, even if that's not the right thing to do, or risk averse for losses when there's a low probability of it. We will accept an unfavorable settlement in various ways. Okay, so in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice there is. So I've shown you a bunch of things. I've hand-waved some whether or not this is actually relevant to people's lives. In our working lives, okay, we're all smart people. We surely wouldn't suffer from any of those effects, right? Well, here's where I have to admit I haven't been telling the whole truth, because a while back I distributed a survey. Anyone in the audience took that survey? Stick your hand up. Oh, a few people. Okay, that's good. So I called it a survey on SRE attitudes to on-call or some such, but in fact it wasn't that at all. In fact, it was a survey which was designed to see if SREs manifested these behaviors that I've just been talking about. The quirks, the cognitive quirks. In particular, I was interested if there was, in fact, any evidence for the proposition that we are better at statistics than, say, some background rate of the general population or different from the norm, especially in skills of probability estimation, risk assessment, accurate decision making under time pressure, and so on. Over 200 of us took the survey, and here are the results. But I do have to say, as I said in the beginning, there is a large question mark over these results, and if there is anyone with actual relevant expertise in the audience who knows this, please come and talk to me, because I'm sure there's a paper here somewhere. Anyway, even if there isn't, it's still interesting. So, some details of the questionnaire, we can go into them later afterwards if you want. Here's the flow of the questionnaire. The basic idea I had for the survey design was that I wanted to see if SREs taking a survey could somehow be caused to perform a task that's quite like on-call and evidence anchoring. So it's kind of difficult to establish this in real life without kind of excessive oversight. Okay, I'll go and sit at your desk and kind of record everything you say in order to figure out if you're going down a blind alley or not. So I hit on the idea of showing you a graph with a time limit and asking you some question about the graph and trying to anchor you on kind of metadata provided. So the graph parsing is kind of 90% of what we do anyway, right, in our lives. Very common operation. And time limited mirrors the stress of the on-call situation. So we've got a time limit to answer the question that pushes you into system one kind of immediately. Anyway, it's useful from the point of view of seeing whether or not I could get that behavior to emerge. So I also randomly showed you the anchored version and the non-anchored version. More detail in a slide or two. We asked risk-oriented questions, talked about availability, and so on. Anyway, so generally speaking, mostly SREs answered it, with a significant bump of software engineers with perhaps accidental production responsibilities, which is interesting. So, first question was a baseline statistics question, which is basically you can win a prize by choosing to draw a marble by one of two urns. Okay, so one of them is, it's not a particularly sophisticated question. 10 marbles, one of which is colored red, is like 100 marbles, 10 of which are colored red, which is 10% chance of success, and 100 marbles, 8 of which are colored red, is just an 8% chance, and so on. So urn A is kind of universally better, but not very many people picked urn B, so we're already doing better than 30 to 40% of students who are recorded as getting this wrong. Okay, that's good. There's some evidence that our understanding is a bit more sophisticated. So this is another interesting one. Do you prefer a 61% chance to win 520K or a 63% chance to win 500K? Okay, so from a raw mathematical point of view, 0.61 times 520 equals 317.2, and 0.63 times 500 equals 315. So therefore, picking the first one, although it's less probable for you to receive something, will maximize your outcome. Of course, the prospect theory says instead that expected gains matter, and like when you're getting a life-changing amount of money, you're adjusting from some status quo. And the marginal utility on 520K versus 500K is essentially nil. So should maximize according to the largest probability of receiving a positive outcome. And that's what we see here. We are risk averse. We want the largest chance of getting something. Okay, so conversely, and I guess this question clarifies it even more, again, the econo-rational thing to do is to multiply the probability by the gain. Expected gain in the 98% is 509K. Expected gain in the 100% case is, of course, 500K. But we overweight the 2% chance of gaining nothing at all, and we go to risk averse. So demonstrating precisely the curve of decisions that we were talking about earlier. So we're risk averse for gains, but in the high probability bucket. And the disparity is presumably a bit greater here because the psychological disparity between 61 to 63, which is the same gap, and 98 and 100 is also greater. So, loss. You run a popular web service. If there is an outage, would you prefer a 61% chance to lose 500 or a 63% chance to lose 480? So this is quite like the previous, of course, except flipping it around to loss rather than gain. SRE is a bit weird in this context, and I struggled a bit with the construction of this questionnaire because we care deeply about loss, but there's hardly any way that we can really be about gain other than by minimizing loss, right? So I guess it could be argued that we could put in a purchase order for more stuff and that would result in gain or something, right? But it's a fairly indirect connection. I don't think we think that way as a community. So these questions are trying to figure out if we still exhibit the pattern as before, except in a different context. So interestingly, this is much more evenly distributed, 60-40. But again, the econorational thing is, well, 0.61 times 500 equals 305k loss versus 0.63 times 480 equals 302.4k loss. So the 63% choice is better, but presumably what's driving the first choice there is the fractionally higher chance of losing nothing. Yep. So if you have a 61% chance of losing 500k, you have a 0.39 chance of losing nothing. But we're risk-seeking because we're taking the option which is actually riskier because we're somehow trying to minimize the loss. And similarly, for this one, okay, this is much more evenly distributed, 60-40 like before. But again, the econorational thing is not necessarily what happens in all cases. 0.98 times 20k is 19.6k versus a sure loss of 18k. So actually, the sure loss of a smaller amount is better. And we're gambling with a 2% chance to lose nothing, because that's obviously better than consolidating a loss. Or maybe not. So this is risk-seeking behavior in the hope of avoiding loss. Okay, so anchoring. This was the most sophisticated question. So I showed you a graph like this and asked you to estimate when the metric hits 1.5 again. So I'm sorry if it's not easily visible from the back, but basically it's a sawtooth graph. It's chopped more or less a little bit before when it would return back to 1.5 again. The most plausible answer, I do agree that the graph could go in all kinds of directions and that's fine, but the most plausible answer is that since 5:30, and that's when it dips down to 1.5 there, it rises for approximately an hour and then drops shortly after the half hour gap, so that's 5:30, 6:30, 6:30, 7:30, 7:30, 8:30, and so on. So it's the kind of thing that's kind of easy to see after the fact. It's not so easy to see when you come up against a question and it says you have 45 seconds to comply, or whatever the wording was. In fact, this is the wording. Well, it's the wording for half of them. We divided the cohort in two. And one group we said, so you're in charge of this important logs processing system used by 900 to 1,000 people in your company. You'll be shown a graph for a small number of seconds and asked to estimate. This is a time-limited question. You will have 45 seconds to answer. And the other cohort saw exactly the same thing without the text about 900 to 1,000 and for 30 seconds instead. So why did I say 900 to 1,000 and why 45 versus 30? Anyone know? Yeah, so I'm trying to confuse you, right? I'm trying to mess stuff up. But 900 to 1,000 kind of looks like 9 o'clock to 10 o'clock. And I also put in values where you could be anchored on the seconds boundary, or sorry, the minutes boundary, as we'll come to see. So the 30-second cohort had an answer graph quite like this, where actually most people got it right. Fantastic. We're good at our job. But there's actually a bit of a bump at 0930. In fact, it's quite a bit larger than 9 and 10. That's interesting. The might be due to anchoring effects, I guess. The 45-second cohort had a distribution graph that looked like this, where, yes, most of us got it right. That's good. But a bunch of us also thought it was 8:45. Not 9:45, well, a little bit. And a bunch of us thought it was 10 o'clock and 9 o'clock as well. So we have been anchored in this graph. We have a bunch of answers that we wouldn't have seen if there hadn't been, we didn't see in the case where we didn't have text that anchored us in that way. This could definitely be redone to be better. Don't make the mistake of thinking that I think this is perfect or that it conclusively demonstrates anything, but it is, to my mind, very, very suggestive that we see those peaks in that way. Anyway, So, also ask some questions about outages. Definition of outage, always good. And we showed you some text anchoring you on 43 minutes or some text anchoring you on 107 minutes. Although the means are different, there's so much noise in the data that it's not, in my opinion, easily attributable to the anchoring effect anyway, so there's more research required there. And now the Linda problem. So, the analog of the Linda problem that I put out was some problem you're debugging with all kinds of specific nonsense about packet loss and firmware upgrades and so on. And then I asked you, is it likely to be a network problem or is it likely to be a network problem specifically related to packet loss? Of course, it's more likely to be a network problem. And we did, in general, pick that. There was 30% of us that was that were fooled by the specific details around packet loss. Much better than the general population, though, 70-30. But I also gave you another problem, which was kind of the Linda problem in disguise, which is some sequence of more, a much more abstract problem about die rolling and colors and so on. The second sequence there is one longer than the first sequence, and so is strictly less probable than that sequence. But it does match the proportions of the die better, and so it attracts a number of people to select that outcome. In the outside world, in the real world, apparently 2/3 of respondents pick that one. Here, we have avoided that, 55 to 40%. This is significantly worse performance than the network question, probably because it's more abstract. And it's not linked to the day-to-day of our experience in such a way. So, anyway, and so in conclusion, or also unfounded baseless allegations that would never survive in a court of law, we are risk-averse with respect to loss and risk-seeking with respect to gains, which is quite unlike the standard prospect matrix theory. We do seem to have a better understanding of statistics intuitively than the population, although perhaps you could argue mostly in domains that we're familiar with. But that's good, because that's what we're on call for. We're not on call for two-colored dice, that's fine. We still do make mistakes, though. But we are vulnerable to anchoring. So, I guess the conflict at the heart of our role with respect to system one and system two behavior, we are pulled towards system one, we actually need system two, or we need to be able to use both of them in the best way when possible. So we need a couple of techniques to help us to manage that, okay? So one that I alluded to earlier, just frowning can help you actually to control the extent between which you slip between system one and system two. Another way is to feel less powerful. What? What do you mean? Feeling less powerful is apparently shown to increase the distrust you have for your own intuition. Actually, that's quite useful. You could read John Allspaugh. He's got lots of stuff, particularly on, if I recall correctly, dynamic fault management and consequent procedures and processes. Another thing that would be good is being on call in teams. Because when you have to explain yourself to somebody, it's kind of a system two interaction as opposed to a system one interaction where you're just allowed to coast on your own intuition. Aggressive rehypothesizing. Okay, we think it's this, but if it wasn't, what would be going on? So brainstorming like that with colleagues can help to yank you out of a dead end. Handoff documents, also articulating what you're doing, very useful. Incident command protocols, which take care of, for example, in the IMAG case, having a communications responder whose job it is to handle the system one style interrupts while you can get on with system two thinking. Limited shift duration, very, very useful, preventing tiredness from depleting your mental resources. Do no harm buttons, that might be useful. In Google, we have a thing called draining, which might do by default when problems happen. Different visualizations of the same thing, which will allow you to conceive of the problem from another angle. If you have an intuition about what's going on, how can you get System 2 to create a test for it? That would be useful as well. You can also anchor yourself on base rates of something happening before somebody anchors you or something anchors you on something else. For example, it's been shown that if you go into a conversation with a used car salesperson and you know the base rate of your car whenever they, the style of your car whenever they try and argue you up or down or whatever, it makes it easier to resist that. And deciding on your risk policy beforehand is very good. But, okay, we've talked about bias, discovered that we do in fact have bias. Take a step back. So here's my larger question, which is, why are we on call at all, right? We've discovered that we have all of these cognitive problems with respect to analysis. This results in the on-call performance we see today. It's not necessarily bad as such, but why are we on call? And I think back to Douglas Hofstadter's book, Godel Escherbach, where he talks about being able to jump out of the system that you're in. And ultimately, in my opinion, on-call is about people looking after a system, being able to jump out of that system and fix problems for the software that the software can't fix itself. Well, actually, given we have all of these problems with how people do on-call, they don't like to do on-call, and the only reason is because the software can't fix its problems itself, what we need to do is to get the software to fix its own problems. So we need to consolidate on cloud stacks that have automation, that have automatic remediation, so that we can move on-call to being a System 2 job done by us, rather than a System 1 job. We're not good at it, we don't like it, and it won't scale. Thank you very much.